Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bipolar Faith, A Black Woman's Journey with Depression and Faith by Monica A. Coleman. Foreword by Tima Bryant Davis. Narrated by Michelle Williams. Foreword. The altar is open. Depression is heavy. Despite its enormous weight, it is not always recognized on the faces of Black women. Depression can peer out in our prayers, reveal itself in our parenting, or manifest itself as strained whispers and vacant eyes. With this courageous memoir, Dr. Monica Coleman shatters the silence and shame surrounding mental illness, inviting the listener to the altar. The altar is the open space at the front of the church where congregants come to pray individually and collectively. They pray with rapid-fire words, with silence, with tears, with moans, with bowed heads and closed eyes, and with heads up and eyes searching the heavens. The altar is the place where performance is not required. It is a place of truth-telling, where for generations, Black people have met God. The trauma of racism, rape, and grief can make it difficult to locate God, which can be disorienting when you have been taught to set your compass on your Creator. This post-trauma quicksand of faith can be especially disturbing for Black women, because we are more likely to indicate that our faith is a source of our strength and resilience. Dr. Coleman uncovers the raw truth around many trauma survivors' disappointment and confusion regarding their faith, given the pervasiveness of violation and oppression. In her truth-telling, she carves out liberation and invites you as the listener to be freed by reimagining your ideas about yourself, your family, and your faith. Dr. Coleman walks us through the beautiful fields and terrorizing landmines of her life journey. In her story, we find glimpses of our story. She invites each of us to speak truth about both the sweetness and the horror of our yesterdays. In her story, we are able to explore the silence and fear of mothers, the secrets that everyone knows but no one speaks, the frustration and despair of fathers, the relief-seeking of those struggling with addiction, the stalking presence of depression, and the painful awkwardness of living in the margins of our own lives. Despite the struggle and strain, Dr. Coleman's story ushers us toward abundance and healing. We are reminded or introduced to the transformative power of creativity, community, journaling, reading, love, culture, and a liberating faith. Bipolar Faith is a timely and timeless gift to Black women and those who care about us. We are invited to join Dr. Coleman in removing the superwoman cape of perfection and to rest in the tenderness of our humanity. As she tells her family's story as well as her own, we are invited to consider the traumas that have been passed down to us physically, emotionally, socially, and spiritually. In the reading, we also discover or remember that we inherited not only ancestral wounds, but ancestral resources. Through Dr. Coleman's lens, we are reminded that much can be gained by reflecting on the layered, complicated stories of those who came before us. These stories are a repository of ways to survive in a world that is often hostile to our existence. The testimonies of those before us and among us unearth strategies for revival when we feel as though we have become dry bones. In this work, we see the importance of holistic, culturally informed healing practices for Black women, including psychotherapy. Womanist psychology, which is a daughter of womanist theology, emerged from the lived experiences, wisdom, and agency of Black women. Bipolar Faith recognizes that our healing must attend to our context, our voices, and our empowerment, so we can not only survive, but thrive. It is not surprising that Dr. Coleman is a leading voice in womanist theology. This book deftly explores the need to cultivate a faith that honors the sacredness of Black women and girls. Dr. Tima Bryant Davis. Prologue. Steal Away to Jesus, Died of Grief. Fountain Inn, South Carolina, mid-1920s. Fountain Inn, South Carolina, mid-1920s. You can die of grief. You can literally get so sad that your heart shrivels up and dies. You can invest so much of what you need in others that you don't know how to live without them. You can't live without what they give you. I know this because my great-grandfather died of grief. That's what Mama told me and what Grandma told her. Grandma's voice explained tersely, "My mother died of pneumonia. The youngest girl, LaPearl, was only 3 years old. 6 months later, my father died of grief." I understand the story to go something like this. My great-uncle Robert was a child. I try to picture the old man I know now, small, dark brown, with thick glasses and graying hair, as a little boy with a big grin. In my mind, boy Robert is wiry and has the same spark in his eyes that great-uncle Robert has when he banters with Grandma. The boy Robert pulled the chair. "Now hold the chair still," said his father. "You got it?" he asked, stepping onto the chair. I imagine my great-grandfather reaching up and fingering the rope, checking to make sure he tied the knot right. "Yes, Daddy," I imagine the twinkle of meeting a parent's approval in boy Robert's eyes. "Now, when I say pull the chair, pull it all the way out, okay?" "Okay," young Robert chirped. "One, two, three, now." Was my great-grandfather calm and relieved as the rope closed in on his neck? Were his eyes bulging? Did his face contort into someone barely recognizable to his sons? Or was the immediate loss of consciousness his first taste of peace in ages? Did boy Robert think it was a trick? "Look at how Daddy's arms and legs thrash, and then stop. Is this a game?" Or did he immediately know something was wrong? Did he run to show his brothers and sisters? Did he tell Uncle Sam, a former slave and family friend? Or did he go outside and play, expecting to see his father later? Did he know he was helping his father commit suicide? The questions raced to my mind. Why did my great-grandfather kill himself? Was he that overwhelmed with the idea of parenting 8 children on his own? Did his wife's death leave a hole in his heart that escaped words? Did he wrestle with mood swings? Did he fear what he might have done to his children if left to his own devices? Did he think he could push through no more pain, poverty, and farmland? Why did he involve his son? Couldn't he do it alone? Did he think of what this would do to my uncle, Robert, the other children, his grandchildren and great-grandchildren? Could he think of anything but escape? No one is alive who can tell me these things, but I know Uncle Sam raised the 8 orphan children. Some stayed down south and some moved north. I was in my late 20s before anyone told the story. One Christmas season, LaPearl's daughter, Grace, fussed in her kitchen, grabbing serving spoons and paper plates to dole out to my awaiting hands and those of my cousins. My cousin Teresa asked what Grace remembered about the South. Grace wiped her hand on her apron and recalled, "When I was 15, we went back to the old house. The rope was still in the shed. They never took it down, you know." Grace lifted her glasses from the beaded chain around her neck and situated them on her nose. She started opening cupboards in search of paper napkins. "People will be here soon. Get the table ready." With spoons and plates in our hands, my cousin Teresa and I walked slowly toward the dining room. We started adding in our heads. Our great-aunt LaPearl wasn't even 18 when she had Grace. We looked at each other with the same realization. The noose was in the shed for 30 years. When I think of growing up in that setting, I begin to understand. Every time they played in the shed, they saw the rope, at least once a week, 10 times a day. They got used to it. It became normal, part of their days. And a heaviness hung over each life, and the sadness remained, like a heavy fog. The fog was so thick the children had to leave. They couldn't see themselves or each other for the ghost-like presence of their father. Maybe the oldest stayed because only he remembered Daddy before the rope. As for the others, Daddy and the rope were synonymous. I understand. They had to leave. Some went as far as the next county, others left the state, moving north to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, New York. As adults, my grandmother's generation refused to speak of it. When forced to, they called it as they felt it, and Grandma said it from her heart. He died of grief. Depression is like grief. It's a sadness that creeps in on you and slowly overwhelms you. Sometimes I feed it like a repast at a funeral. Other times I sing and shout my way through it. But after the relatives leave and the food is eaten and the lights go off, it's still there. And it feels so bad that you try to escape it by any means necessary. No one diagnosed my great-grandfather with depression. No one diagnosed Grandma. Who's to know or care about the mental and emotional state of poor sharecroppers from South Carolina? And who can stop to think of a clinical illness when the children need to be fed? What's the difference between depression, war, being black in the Jim Crow South, and plain old hard living? Who would know to alert children or grandchildren to the slippery slope of despair? Without the story of Great Uncle Robert and his father, I only knew that grief kills. There was no judgment or blame, just a fact. 2 breaths out of slavery, and my great-grandfather still wasn't free. He was oppressed by the memories of his wife, his fears, the burdens of what lay ahead. Sadness can own you. You can die of grief. It took me years to learn what generations of African Americans have long understood. There are things worse than death. Part 1. Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Teenager, Michigan, 1988 to 1991. 1. Grandma, Washington, D.C., February 1988. The South Carolina cousins placed buckets of fried chicken on the piano bench, and my faith decreased and my depression increased with each wing that was eaten. We treated Grandma's funeral like a family reunion. Have you got yourself some chicken, baby? Who's your mama? Are La Pearl and them here yet? She always adored you, grandchildren. Brown, wrinkled fingers picked up a napkin and wiped a bit of grease from the side of a mouth. As the relatives stood up, the plastic covering on the pale blue sofa made a creaking sound. I was 13 and too young, my parents said, to wear a black dress. So I donned a navy dress with a Peter Pan collar and soft yellow and blue lace trim on the sleeves that my great aunt sewed just for the day. I slid into the back of the limousine with my 2 first cousins. It was the first time I saw a dead body. I stood in front of the casket and looked for a long time. I stared so long that I swore I saw Grandma's chest move up and down. Not much, just a little. I wanted to yell and grab Mama and tell her to call the doctors and morticians and say that a mistake had been made and Grandma was not really dead, just very sick. I blinked again, and everything was still. During the final viewing, I walked up to the casket with Mama's hand in mine. But Mama, it doesn't look like her. What's wrong? It doesn't look like her. Pulling me to an angle, Mama said, look from this way. She was lying on this side when she died. Look from this way. I moved to the right and tilted my head, trying to see what Mama saw. I looked another 30 seconds, and she still didn't look like Grandma to me. The woman in front of me had darker skin and was thin enough to be called skinny. Her wig wasn't centered, and she didn't have on her glasses. This woman's eyes were closed and looked as though she had never baked, fussed, insisted, laughed, or doted. The body in the casket didn't look anything like my grandma. I squinted my eyes. From the sides of my eyes, I saw the deacons in the front row. Black suits, black ties, old and slim, their backs seemed hunched as they rocked back and forth. When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell O Pharaoh to let my people go. The funeral was getting ready to start, and it was time to sit down. I squinted my eyes again. I turned to Mama. Now I see. It looks like Grandma from this angle. My mother smiled, and I walked away mumbling to myself, Imposter. The woman in that casket was not my grandma. That's not how I remembered her. When I thought of Grandma, I thought of D.C. and D Street. As far as I could tell, black people lived in D.C., white people lived in Washington. It took years for me to realize that the place with the White House, Georgetown, the Supreme Court, and Congress is the same city to which I traveled every summer of my pre-adolescent life. Every summer after age 5, my parents boarded me on a plane with shiny patent leather shoes, a friendly flight attendant, and the promise of a good time with my grandparents and cousins. There was often another child traveling alone, like the girl with blonde Shirley Temple curls and a red and white checkered jumper. We chatted and ate peanuts all the way from Detroit Metropolitan Airport to Washington National Airport. We became friends in the air, but we parted on the ground. I ran from the attendant's hand to my grandmother, grandfather, aunt, or uncle. Shirley Temple, too, ran to her responsible relative. At that point, we separated. She went to Washington, and I ventured into D.C. D.C. was a place filled with corner stores, alleys, and row houses. D.C. had broken bottles, screaming ambulance sirens, sidewalks for hopscotch, scratched-out stickball fields, and wire fences high enough to make climbing a challenge. When I went to D.C., I stayed in the same section of the city, and that section was filled with black people. In fact, most of the black people that I knew in D.C. were either related to me or knew my relatives. As far as I was concerned, D.C. was one block long and two alleys deep on either side of the center of the world, 15th and D Streets, Northwest. Grandma made it seem like the world revolved around us grandchildren. We were all special for different reasons. Wesley was the oldest and the only boy. Teresa was the baby. And me, I was the oldest girl, and I came from far away, only on vacations. The summers belonged to my cousins, Grandma, and me. We could always expect our favorite foods, upside-down pineapple cake, barbecued beef, and the apple turnovers Grandma called Applejacks. Grandma was a woman too old, in my mind, to wear the short dresses I saw in older pictures. She took 5 minutes to read the menu at the McDonald's drive-thru, and I often played her affection off my parents' restrictions. "But Grandma said she'll get it for me," I'd say, whatever it was I wanted that had been vetoed by my parents. Grandma was a woman who believed that little girls should wear frilly underwear, even though it itched. And she believed in braiding hair every morning, even if it looked fine from the day before. While most of my time was spent playing with my cousins, Grandma always made sure that we had time alone. "Grandma, why do we go to church every Sunday? And why do we have to stay there all day? How come I can't sleep during the sermon anymore? What's a revelation?" "Just keep quiet and watch after me," was the usual response to my weekly questions. As a deaconess at Shiloh Baptist Church, Grandma had a lot of church business to attend. We made the communion. On the Saturday before the first Sunday of every month, we broke the crackers into little bits so that everyone could eat them. Actually, I didn't do anything. I was supposed to sit in the corner and read my book, but I watched so intensely, I could have been serving the communion myself. First, open the large orange and green boxes of flat crackers. Eat a couple to be sure they are fresh. Give some to the children to keep them quiet. Then lay them out on the long shiny table and begin to break them. Keep your gloves on. Then get the Welch's from the refrigerator, and don't let the children have any of this. Pour it very carefully into the little cups. If you spill it, you have to clean up the whole mess and put on new gloves. Then put all the little cups into the little holes in the shiny gold container. Wash your hands, and done. And the most important thing is to tell the children that they can't have any until the Sunday that they walk down the aisle for themselves and are baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Grandma grasped my hand and led me down the spiral staircase back to the car, talking about bedtimes and young minds. She told me how God had blessed us, and that tonight she'd answer some of the questions as best she could. My mind tried to think of the most important question, in case there wasn't time for all of them. Meanwhile, Grandma pressed a $5 bill into the mitten of a homeless man next to the car. Before I asked, she said, "He needs it more than we do. You give a dollar to the Lord, and he will reward you tenfold, hundredfold, thousandfold." Grandma saw God in a homeless man. Then the cancer returned. When I heard the word, I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know that people died of cancer. I didn't know that it could sweep in like a windstorm and knock the breath out of a person, a family. I didn't know that it could leave as quietly as it seemed to come and could lie dormant for years. I didn't know that it required children to act like parents. I didn't know how hard it was to ask your granddaughter to give you a bedpan because you couldn't lift yourself up. I didn't know how terrible the large spoonfuls of kale pectate tasted when there used to be a time when you could chew a steak. I didn't know anything about death or unfulfilled dreams because Grandma refused to let anyone know she thought about it. Grandma was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1963, but by 1983 she had been in remission despite lymphoma, leukemia, and the double mastectomy. Quickly, we grandchildren were informed of her condition, and we came to know all the actions that made up daily living with and fighting cancer. That summer, we lifted, fed, and held Grandma. We combed her hair, straightened her wigs, brought back bulletins from church services, and ran water for her baths. We were scared, but silently followed the orders of our mothers. Do what Grandma asks and be good. One day in August, Grandma got up, walked into the kitchen, said the peaches were rotting and needed to be canned, and told us, "You better pick those apples for some applejacks if you want them by dinner." Grandma was back, and we never really thought a time would come when she wouldn't eventually get up from the bed to can food and cook our favorites. We continued to dream and talk of our future careers, discuss where we would go to college, and ask, "Grandma, will you come to the embassy when I'm a famous interpreter for all the big events?" "Of course I'll be there. I'll buy a new hat for the occasion." Remission came and went with Grandma. Although I had wiped saliva from her mouth, run baths, given medication, and accompanied her on numerous trips to the doctor, I never believed Grandma would die. She had been sick before. Sick enough that everyone thought she was dying, for good this time. Most of her adult nieces and nephews huddled around her bed at Christmas. But she only pursed her lips together as if to spit, gathered all her available energy, and said, "You all need to go home. I ain't dead yet." Turning to the other side, she called out, "Maxine, Pauline," the names that sent her twins running to her bedside. And we knew, as always, that this was not the end. Grandma was invincible. But remissions end, and Grandma moved from the dilapidated but love-filled row house in D.C. into Teresa's room in a cozy Baltimore neighborhood, nestled between Reisterstown Road Plaza and the Jewish community of Pikesville. It was then that cancer became real. This time, Grandma's hair did not grow back when Teresa and I platted it, telling her it was beautiful. This time, Grandma did not get up to cook, but winced away when we held the spoon of liquid medication. This time, it took 45 minutes to move Grandma into the living room to watch us open gifts on Christmas. I watched my grandmother transform from the grandma on whose knee I sat into a woman who needed my help to turn to her side. In 3 short years, I saw her skin darken permanently and her cheeks sink into the cavity of her skull. I heard her voice grow weaker as I watched the pain remove all pride and embarrassment. By the time she died, she could no longer mother. She could no longer grandmother. Her strength and esteem seemed to slip away every time I wiped the crust from her eyes. At age 11, I knew that chemotherapy meant to pick out a new wig. I knew that morphine meant the end was near. I knew cancer, and I hated it. Despite all of this, my memories of Grandma don't focus on stuffed bras and vials of blood. I remember the row house packed with the DC relatives, mothballs, Grandma's church clothes, and plastic-covered furniture. I like thinking about the 25-cent candy bars at the corner store and Grandma's threatening voice about climbing the fence. I think about giving money to the homeless and finding holiness in grape juice. I planned to move to D.C. one day. I told people in Michigan that I wanted to live in a city with subways, train stations, and dirty streets. I told my friends that I would live rent-free with an aunt or uncle. I even said that I longed to live in a city with more Black people. What I did not say is that I wanted to go to Arlington National Cemetery. I wanted to be able to wind around the curves circling the nearly identical white markers until I stopped the car at the nearest pathway. I wanted to ignore the numbered placards that distinguished the Vietnam veterans from the World War II heroes from the children of Korean warfighters. I wanted to walk until I saw the tree with the low bending branch and the stone with 2 engraved sides, Grandpa's name on one side and Grandma's name on the other. I knew that I would need immediate access to this particular hill of dirt in order to survive. I imagined living in D.C. I would sit down and hug the stone. I would talk to Grandma as if she were still here. I would ask her if she could believe all the foolishness that Cousin so-and-so had gotten into. I would ask her if she liked the way I did my hair. I would tell her about my school papers and grades. I would tell her that I still needed her to believe in me. My 13-year-old Faith was buried with Grandma that rainy day at Arlington. Grandma did not just believe in my dreams, my future, and my potential. Grandma believed me. Although I don't remember ever telling her with words, I believed that she knew. She knew all the reasons that I was there every summer. She knew about the life I lived in Michigan, a life that I lacked a vocabulary to voice. I hated being an only child. I always wanted a sister. I wanted an older sister. I conjured her up in my mind. She would be sophisticated and savvy. She would know the words to all the latest songs and know all the moves from the corresponding videos. Her hair would be cut in the most modern styles, and she would smell like Estee Lauder's Beautiful. She would be very popular and have her choice of boyfriends. She would have a tight circle of girlfriends who were so cool that they let me hang out with them too. Because she was so pretty and charming, she would walk the mall and heads would turn to see her and her friends walking 4 abreast. She would be, in essence, everything I was not. And she would teach me how to be all those things I desired. But there would be no more children. I am the only child my mother could have. There would not be the 4 children she and Daddy planned. No rusty butt boys, maybe 2. And no sisters. I am, she said, the miracle baby. I am, Mama always said, the one God wanted her to have. There's another reason I wanted a sister. I wanted someone else who had the same parents and knew what it was like inside our house.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?